Welcome to Strain Talk. This is Nick McCombs, your co-host, along with Mike Morris. We are here to explore the world of genetics in the cannabis industry, see what is efficacious and what works for us, and hopefully learn what works for you as well. I am a cannabis grower with about 5 years of commercial experience. Got the opportunity to grow many, many strains and really explored that interest within the different things that make them different, such as terpenoids and cannabinoids. So I'd like to share all that knowledge that I've learned and soak up some more from our co-host, Mike Morris. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce him to you all right now. Mike, thank you for joining us. It's going to be great being co-host with you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invite. So my name is Mike Morris, pretty much known as the guy on FB who talks about pot all the time. it's really been a true pleasure, you know, to be able to, you know, deal with a very severe case of refractory status epilepticus that I've had for about 25 years now due to a TBI. And it's a progressive epilepsy. So the years of uncontrolled seizures really, really did a lot of damage to the actual structure of my brain as well. Whereas I had brain surgery about 9 years ago. And unfortunately, the scarring led to more scarring as the seizures went over the scar area. So during surgery, I had one seizure focus. Now I have about five or six. So using cannabis and having to stay on top of, you know, a lot of just personal experimentation and research combined, you know, to kind of help me along that path. And it's someone who used to use and grow cannabis from teenager to until about 4 years ago when I had stopped, that's when the refractory status started. So apparently I was refractory status for many years beforehand, but because I smoked cannabis, I was actually, you know, treating that. It wasn't until I stopped that, boom, they started hitting 4 to 5 days a week. So, you know, after going through all the legalities, I got my grower's permit and my medical permit, which gives me kind of a dual advantage of being to experiment with strains that I grow, and that way you get to see seed to finish, and then also being able to, you know, use the good medical dispensaries here and find, you know, different strains. I've probably tried 40 or 50 different strains over the last couple of years, and definitely made some correlates, what doesn't work for me and what does, and just kind of want to introduce everybody to not just your basic THC, CBD, but like Nick said, terpenoids, and also a very underlooked aspect, which is flavonoids. Beautiful. And how they interact with our own bodies. So our bodies are, I'd like to say, we're walking cannabis plants because we have an endocannabinoid system as well. So how does that tie in together, and how do we find the right strains or combinations of to meet our own personal needs?
Beautiful. Yep, exactly. I love it. I can already tell that, I mean, you are on the same page as far as our beliefs within the plant itself. You said that the refractory status didn't start showing up until you had quit using cannabis. Was this... prior to that, were you able to have access to a diverse of strains, or did you just have to kind of get what you could have?
I just got what I could have, you know. So, you know, sometimes it was good, sometimes it was bad, but I pretty much, even though I would go into status, complex partial status, that was a little bit easier to deal with. I would have 300 or 400 complex partials a day. So it made work very tough, and, you know, certainly couldn't drive or anything like that. But as far as tonic-clonic seizures goes, I would maybe have one a year, one every 2 years and stuff. So it was still completely controlling that, but it wasn't quite So what I needed to do was find, once I got the medical aspect, then I was able to find how to treat it as my, is you have to treat it from the very root, the simple partial, the complex partial, to keep it from progressing to a tonic-clonic. So it was more just, okay, you know, I need to knock it all the way down. So it was finding the right combination and, you know, of strains and extracts as well that allowed me to be able to sort of nip it down at a root level.
Yeah, so that's something that I know a lot of people that are like not in medical states and such that are going to be listening to this show, they're going to be real envious that we have access to even the diverse range that we do at dispensaries and such to experiment and kind of try and find that special key that is a strain that unlocks our full potential. I definitely have found that's kind of like what started my whole career was I found a strain, Lemon G13, that seemed to work really well for my attitude and just keep me upbeat and motivated and everything I was looking for out of a cannabis plant. And I generated towards that dispensary and volunteered my time and became a grower. So like that's how important a real good genetic is. I was willing to you know, I actually worked for free for a little while just because I wanted access to this strain within my own home garden. So that's kind of why I asked that question. Wanted to hear exactly if your experience was the same as beforehand. Many things we were probably treating with street cannabis, illegal cannabis, whatever you want to call it, and didn't even realize how much of a medical effect it was having on us until the science and the industry has kind of been thrown into the public picture here in the last couple of years.
Oh, absolutely. I went through the same. So it was basically, that was basically one strain that was my catalyst as well. It was a Pineapple OG, which is Pineapple Express and OG Kush, very simple cross. But for some reason, that one just clicked with me. And from that, I really realized why it was working was I still wasn't completely controlled at that time. I was still having, you know, a couple of ER visits then. But I noticed that since I like to use teeth a lot, whether it's in oils or whether, you know, it's even combustion or vaporization. And while when I sifted the keef, I realized every day that I would sift it, the aroma from it, I would not have any seizures at all. And I was like, oh, and that's, you know, so I brought it up to them at the dispensary and they were like, yeah, duh, terpenes, you know.
Right. Like, you're saying just sniffing it.
Like, absolutely.
Interesting. Yeah, you've heard of the study, I'm sure, about if you eat a mango before you smoke, it opens up the membrane, blood brain barrier, so it makes the THC interact faster. It's the same thing with, it's just the flavonoids like you brought up earlier. If you smell your sack before you smoke it, it's going to hit you a little faster, so they say.
Yep, absolutely. I know I learned a lot from David Mates out in California, and he treats, you know, he swears by the sniff test, even for very young patients and ill patients. You can almost see their eyes light up or their facial expressions when you actually put a, you know, actually have a strain above that you can put under their nose. You can literally see their reaction on their face. And you can almost, you know, you can almost get a good plan going just from that alone.
Oh, that's beautiful. I never thought about that, but that is very interesting. And that's pretty much how everybody buys cannabis is, oh, I like the smell of that one and I'll take that one. So that makes a lot of sense. It's your own brain telling you, like, this is what you need.
Yeah, I look at it like food. You know, is that if it smells good, chances are you're going to like it. It's going to taste good.
Right.
If you don't like the smell of it, you're not going to like the taste of it. It's all, there's so much that's interconnected in cannabis that it's just wild, you know. And what's very interesting is the way cannabis grows, the whole synthase process from root and then all the way into your flavonoids and then your flavonoids mix with your terpenoids and then your terpenoids and flavonoids. combine with your acids or your uranylpyrophosphate, and then it forms cannabinoids. So there's this whole way that cannabis, that the actual trichome, the medicinal part, grows, you know, but it goes all the way down to a deeper level, all the way into the, from the roots to the stems and, you know, into the bracts of the leaves and stuff. And what's really interesting is that the color, of course, we're talking about smell a lot with terpenes, with flavonoids. Flavonoids are what adds color to cannabis. So you can almost get an idea of what flavonoids are in there just based upon the color, which is pretty neat too. So there's color, aroma, because cannabinoids are completely odorless, so and colorless. So
right.
You know, so a good way to check is, you know, by smell and by sight, you can almost get a good idea over time of what you're looking for.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's interesting information. I didn't know that flavonoids affected the color of the bud like that. So how many strains, now that you have access, how many strains do you have that you think you'll take throughout your whole life, or that you just live by until you find something that will replace them?
You know, definitely the pineapple OG is one of my favorites. I really like the combination of fruity and then the very fuely ones. Your Ken Dogs. I've been really enjoying the effects of juicy fruit, which is very mild in the realm of THC CBD content. You know, it's really not a very potent strain, but it's got really huge resin glands, which tells me that there's a lot more going on that plant than just cannabinoids. And that's very fruity, and it kind of helps to ease the sort of, you know, the terpene content in the, let's see, I'm doing a sour double Ken Dog right now. That is, you know, the smell will just clear the room, you know, so it's very high in terpenes. And then it almost seems like the fruitier strains, like a juicy fruit or something like that, or the pineapple OG kind of knocks that down a little bit. So you kind of get a good combination of, you get a good combination of flavors. And then, I really enjoy the sedative effects of an indica dominant headband. That one works really well for me. And I believe it's, you know, even if it's sativa dominant, it has a high amount of myrcene that you find in mangoes. So I believe that it helps to speed up so that you're really absorbing the THC. You know, there's a vast difference between what your lab test says and what is actually going into your bloodstream.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point too, is the numbers don't tell the whole story for sure. Same thing with my favorite strain. It's a very low THC strain. You know, I've got it up to 19%, but that's with a lot of work. But it just smells off the charts, and I think that's really becomes overlooked in a lot of consumers and a lot of awards that are based off of numbers and such.
Right, definitely. And that's one thing is it's all the CBD strains. We have a very limited amount here in New Mexico, unfortunately. And I use just your basic sort of original cannatonic, you know, which is your basic, you know, D13, G14, and MK cross. And to be honest with you, I actually would have to wear a mask when I extracted it. It just, the smell gave me a headache. Everything was so strong. But then to other people, it smelled so good. And that's when they started realizing the whole, you know, smell test aspect of it. And I was like, you know, so I know that there's definitely some CBD strains out there that would probably work for me. And I would base it now upon how it smells as opposed to what the actual numbers are. But good job on 19%. That's pretty good. Highest I've had is 17.5%.
Oh yeah. Well, and who knows, these labs, I don't even trust them, to be honest with you, but, thank you anyway. So what in a CBD strain, you think you want a fruity one? Is that what you're looking for then?
Yes, definitely. definitely. I actually had found one that it didn't give me the sort of adverse kind of reaction, but I just wanted to try it out, so I only bought a gram, so I can't really base how it really made me feel over the long term, because it was only a gram. But it was an interesting, it was bright purple, which means it has anthocyanins in it, which are extremely antioxidant and anti-inflammatory as well. So I think that definitely helped. It was much fruitier. And it was a interesting strain because it has CBDV in it also, plus THCV in almost equal proportions. It was a one-to-one on CBD, CBDV, THC, and THCV.
Wow, so interesting.
I'll look at some more. I believe it was crossed with Jack the Ripper, and Jack the Ripper is very well known for its barium content.
Interesting. I want to go back real quick to, you said Kenatonic is G13 MK Ultra?
Yes.
Interesting. I did not. And have you ever seen the real G13?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Does any of that carry over?
Dispensary here.
Does the Kenatonic look like G13 at all?
It doesn't look quite as much as you would expect. It's a more, I've noticed that G13s tend to, they tend to foxtail sometimes and stuff, whereas this Kenatonic is a very sort of, even though it's sativa dominant, it's a very thick, chunky, dense bud.
Interesting. So, reset. Oh, yeah, beautiful. Amy had mentioned maybe we should touch on some of the confusion of strains as far as names of strains that have been distorted or changed over time. Are you familiar with any cases like that?
I am, but I'm not versed enough to really get down to the very bottom, you know,
right,
without the whole commercial aspect going in. So I would probably leave that one up to you.
Yeah, and I am pretty close to some stuff like that. I was at the warehouse where R4 originated, and allegedly, or some people believe, is Charlotte's Web. I mean, it's pretty obvious to most people that it's the same plant. If we did do the, whole spectrum testing, you'd be able to tell for sure. So that's one of the most famous ones, of course. I can think of several that have been changed because of inappropriateness, like Jew Gold is now Kosher Kush, stuff like that.
Kosher Kush actually was a very good one for me too. It's a really interesting strain.
Yeah, that's one of the strains that I will turn around and go into a dispensary to buy as well. I like that one a lot, and I've thought about picking it up in seed form or something. It sounds like you mostly grow from seed. Is that correct?
Actually, I can get clones from our dispensary when they're available, which is really nice. So I tend to, if they have something that I have smoked and I have liked, then I will ask them for a clone from it, and they're usually accommodating about that, which is really cool. But I do like, since I'm really starting to get my feet wet again into growing, is that I like to go from seed, just to kind of see it go from start to finish. I think there's a really cool aspect in that regard of it too. And then if I like it, I can just clone off of that. So
right. And out there is what are some of the most popular strains for true conditions such as cancer and such?
Well, actually, here in New Mexico, a lot of people, we don't get, there's not great programs for kids here as far as your financial assistance and help with disability and stuff. So we get a lot of retirees, middle-aged to older patients. Are cancer, PTSD, and HIV are probably our three main conditions that are treated here in New Mexico. There's actually a very low amount of inroads for epilepsy. But one thing that I always see, especially at, you know, at my favorite dispensary, is they really like to stick with OG crosses. They also like to stick with, you will always see Blue Dream there. You will always see a Kendall, you know, there too. So, which I kind of like, because I really like those precursor genetics. I really like a land race, or your next step up above land race. And I wrote a list of kind of how, you know, one thing that definitely helps with even looking online is, let's say you lived in a legal state and you wanted to take a vacation to another legal state, but you can't take your medicine with you on the plane. And so they need to find something as close as possible. So a good thing to do is to research, you know, see what dispensaries are carrying what online at the state you're going to, and then doing a check online of what the genetics are. And you can just type in the name of the strain, and then genetics is your keyword on your search bar, and it'll usually pop up with, you know, exactly where it came from. And you'll see that there's really just a few main genetics out there that kind of lead to all these vast number of strains we have. So one good thing would be to sort of go by what the original cross was, even if it's a different name and maybe a slightly different ratio, is to kind of try to stick with those same genetic precursors in the strain you're taking in your home state to what you're using in another state.
Right. Yeah, I'm right there with you with seeking out those land races or those second step ups. I collect mostly genetics that are at least 20 years old. I have, you know, a handful of strains that are about
my chem dogs. And
yeah, I'm trying to collect all the chem dogs. Actually, I have chem 4 and chem D right now. And I'm hoping to get chem 91. The other ones are even more elusive, but hopefully I can round them up one day.
Original cut myself, but right now the dispensary had clones of the Sour Double Dog, so it was like, and that's a pretty complicated strain, so because it's crossed with Sour Diesel, and then from Sour Diesel you go down to you know, the other aspects that go into what makes up the chem dog phenos, you know. And there's so much mystery behind the original, how chem dog came about. You know, you will read a million different stories, and it's always a different band that the guy bought the pot from that he found the chem dog seed and stuff. Well, I don't know which one's true and stuff, but it's mysterious. But there would be no OG Kush or Sour Diesel without chem dog.
Yeah, I'm certain on the Sour Diesel. I'm pretty convinced on the Grateful Dead concert story. I've kind of had the opportunity of running in those circles a little bit and talking to Michael Nee, who's actually at the concert that sold, Chem Dog, the dog bud that had the seed that became all the Chem Dog strains. So I've had those face to face conversations, so I believe that one, and it's really interesting. And I asked him if he thought that the OG Kush lineage came from it, and he couldn't say for sure. He doesn't know. He doesn't really even care. He loves the Chem Dog strain so much, but you know, he did confirm for sure that Chem 91 is the parentage of Sour Diesel. And it's interesting. You see that, like you mentioned, most of these strains, are all derivatives, and a lot of them are kicked down. So it makes you wonder what are some of these corporations that we all fear, not to name any names, but genetically modified organizations, what they're going to do with these strains, and how they're going to tweak them and pervert them. And I don't know, how do you stand on that? I'm not really in favor of anything other than selective breeding. I think I don't like feminized breeding, you know. I'm sure you feel the same way. It destabilizes genetics.
I absolutely Yeah, I've usually don't even grow feminized seeds. I like regular seeds, the way they're naturally produced on the plant, you know. And then, you know, as far as breeding goes, I would love to learn as much as you know about the actual breeding process of it and stuff. I'm a self-proclaimed pollen chucker.
That's all I am too. That's all I am too. I mean, I just got some good strains to throw some pollen on. That's all there is to it. I mean, if Johnny Law would leave me alone and just, you know, recognize it being a plant as a plant, I would have 100 seeds at a time and be a real breeder. But you got to break the laws if you want to be a real breeder.
That's fine. Is that we have a 16 plant count here in New Mexico, but we can only flower 4 at a time. You know, so basically, you know, if I wanted to seed some of them, I would only have 3 plants that would actually, you know, produce the amount of resin that I would need, you know, and the other one, of course, would be dedicated to just seed production. So it makes it kind of tough, you know, to, you know, as a home grower to do that with that restricted number that we can have in flower. So.
Yeah, that's wild. The magical 6 number is just drives me crazy. And for somebody with real needs like you, I know you make oil, so I know it's just not you smoking. You actually need massive amounts. I make oil myself, so I know it takes ounces and ounces just to make a couple grams of oil, and some patients need a gram a day. So the whole number of plants is just dumbfounding to me. So I know that is a strain on you. So it probably makes you look for strains that are high yielding. Also, so it like adds a different component to what you're looking for your medicine, right?
Oh, definitely. I have to take both into account for sure. You know, so because, you know, most of, I'd say about 80% of what I go through gets turned into oil. You know, I like solventless hash is my base. So I do a basic ice water extraction with bubble bags. And for each strain, and I set them aside, or and then I'll do a little bit of keep as well. And that way, you know, I don't really have to worry about, you know, too much about, you know, using Everclear and, you know, any sort of other solvents and stuff. I'm certainly years away from being to afford anything super critical. So that's something that I didn't even think about quite yet. So pretty much I focus on what is going to work for my home technique oils. You know, as you know, some strains don't wash very well for making bubble hash. And some strains don't really do as great. They all sort of, you kind of have to judge, like, you know, I like to look at the viscosity of the trichomes. Really, really, really sticky ones are, you know, pretty hard to wash. You have to be pretty precise with them. You know, so that was one thing I found out is that, you know, I kind of wasted a lot of pot trying to wash that one. You know, maybe I should have, you know, infused that in oil. Maybe I should have just done a basic Everclear extraction on that.
What are some of those harder strains that you found to wash? That way some people out there aren't thinking that they're just doing a bad job. It's just, you know, like even I've had that same problem where it's like, wow, this looks so frosty. But for whatever reason, it just doesn't wash out as well. I think sometimes it has oils and stuff.
Well, what I like to look for is, let's see, the best yield I got off of was the sour double pin dog. And what's funny about it is that the trichomes are actually super small. So I actually got a better yield out of the 25 micron bag than I did the 73, you know, which is usually the opposite. Usually your smallest yields off of that, but it caught all those small trichomes that fell off. So even though, you know, it didn't look the greatest, but it gave me a good yield because, you know, those smaller micron bags will catch that sometimes falls through in the water. And I think, let's see, the juicy fruit washed terribly when it was fresh frozen, but washed great when cured. So there's also that factor. Usually if it's a super sticky trichome, it almost works better if you cure it and then freeze it and then wash it. And if you have a really solid trichrome on the fresh frozen, then run it fresh frozen. So I kind of judge it by the way the trichrome looks and also feels.
Beautiful. Yeah. See, this is the type of knowledge that I like to pick up from you. And I'm sure a lot of listeners are going to get a lot of value from as well. Being able to know that there's different techniques. It's just like growing. I'm sure you grow organically and everybody should. But there's many ways to skin a cat, many ways to process the plant, many ways to cure the plant. It sounds like, do you have any smokables that you cure?
I cure about 20% of what I grow. I keep basically 20% of my yield for curing. So.
And what's your curing process? Just out of curiosity.
My what?
What is your curing process? What, like how long? And do you do it? Do you hang dry it and then store it in the jars, or do you like wet trim?
I like to, because I don't want the lipid layer to break down too quick on the trichomes, I like to completely get it as clean as I possibly can right off the plant. So I trim it, you know, all the way down to the calyxes, you know, maybe a little bit of sugar leaf, all the way down to the plant, and then I hang it in the dark. Here in New Mexico, you don't get the greatest cure because it's so dry where I live. But actually, this summer was friendly to us. We had a nice wet summer, so I got a better cure. But definitely, if it was a dry summer, I would definitely add a humidifier to that. Because about 40% relative humidity is about where you want to be for a cure. And try to keep it in the dark for as long as possible as well. And it usually only takes like 5 to 6 days to dry, depending on the size of the of the cola, the buds, and then I like to after 5 to 6 days of hanging is then when I jar it up, and I, because it's still a little bit wet after 5 to 6 days, I burp the jar, you know, just basically pop the lid on the mason jar in the morning and in the evening to release some of that moisture so that I don't get any mold.
And as always, some of that's going to be strain dependent as well, as far as density and such.
They all will be off a day or two. You know, you can't really have a definite number. You know, it all depends on, you know, it all depends on the structure of the flower.
Yeah. Growing cannabis will teach you to appreciate the old adage. Don't count your chickens before they hatch, because weed can look like it's going to be real dense and it'll dry out and lose a lot of its weight, or, you know, just all sort of, you know, like the curing process go wrong and it won't quite taste where you're hitting for. Here in Colorado, we have kind of the same problem with the super dryness, you know, being a big migratory spot here. A lot of people complain about the strains not tasting the same in this climate as it did, like particularly Sour Diesel tasting a lot better on the East Coast and stuff like that. And they attribute that a lot to humidity. And I find that even during the growing conditions, your humidity level plays a huge difference, obviously on water and nutrient uptake, but also on the expression of the terpenoids and flavonoids. Have you also experienced that?
Oh, absolutely. It's like I look at the difference between your classic OG Kush cross and then like an SFV OG that was grown in the San Fernando Valley are almost different in effects, smell, the whole thing, even though they're so genetically similar, you know, and basically, you know, it's done in a drier, hotter climate, you know, so, you know, there's of course, slight differences in the genetics, but the genetic makeup is fairly similar, but it's actually quite different in effect. So, and I think so much has to do with climate. It's like when we go to talking about land races and the way the sun hits. Well, the reason why most indicas come from a higher elevation, like, you know, the Hindu Kush region and Nepal, things like that, is that there's so much UV light at altitude. And I live at 7,000 feet, and I think Colorado Springs is around the same, is that the size of the fan leaves are what gives the plant shade, because you don't want direct sunlight 100% on the whole plant, you know. So so those big white shade leaves kind of help to block a little bit of that really direct UV light that comes from a high altitude condition. And then, you know, you see your sativas where they don't have to worry so much about that. So you have your more really big, thin leaves that are more spread out. And those typically come from equatorial regions and also lower altitude regions. So climate has a huge factor to play in that.
Right. Yeah, these the stretches on sativas make it pretty hard to find one that is suitable for most home growers and yields within a timely fashion. So that's kind of where we all have our hybrids these days. I was had a barbecue mm-hmm. with about five or six other growers last weekend, and you know, they were all indica this, sativa that, and I'm kind of really gotten away from those two classifications because it's all been muddied and watered down. I think getting more onto the terpenoids and flavonoids and cannabinoid ratios is really what's important, not growth structure and such. Although obviously there's propensities of the indicas to have certain effects and certain terpenoids.
Yeah. In fact, you can almost guarantee a person that has a sativa that's high in myrcene, it's going to hit like an indica. And it's, so it makes it hard to, you know, the old classification of indicas are a body high and sativas are a head high, you know, is not really the case. That's dependent on the terpene content and also how they work together. So a high myrcene strain is going to be sedative, no matter sativa or indica. And then, you know, if you look at like pinene, you know, which is a little more uplifting, you know, that's definitely, you know, it'll be, yeah, it'll be uplifting in an indica when you're expecting sedatives. So really that's where you need to look for the effects.
How about this? Do you grow, have you noticed certain bugs or pests are more attracted to some of these different flavonoids and terpenoids? Because I have some strains, some of my sour strains seem to attract pests more. Do you notice that?
Actually, yeah, the biggest one I had, the biggest one I had was a big bud white rhino cross. And that one, the fruit flies love, which is pretty interesting. And what it is, was fruit flies are pretty harmless. You see them stuck on your trichomes, you take them off. And that leads to such a cool effect in that, you know, as long as you don't have really damaging, like, leaf-eating pests and stuff, you know, or mites, something like that, but your natural insects that just fly around, is that cannabinoids are, you know, or, you know, resin glands, basically, not just cannabinoids, but the resin gland, all that really is a fly trap for cannabis. It's its protection mechanism. So all these wonderful, huge medicinal benefits of it are basically its own bug killer, you know, or trapper. It doesn't really kill them, but it traps them. Because I noticed that all those little fruit flies never actually got to a bud. As soon as they would hit the sticky trichomes, they get stuck. So, and what's also kind of interesting is they will, dependent on, you know, if a couple bugs land on there or something, you're guaranteed that it's going to produce even more resin to try to fight that off. So it's part of an interesting thing about, you know, some of the good things about if you're outdoor of, you know, controlling your predatory pests, but, you know, sort of just letting nature do its course with, you know, the harmless one. And indoors, I like to use ladybugs because ladybugs kill the bad pests, but also the plant doesn't know if it's good or bad. It feels a bug on it and it wants to trap it. So ladybugs can actually increase resin production because the plant feels a foreign insect landing on it that it doesn't want. So, you know, it responds by producing more sticky resin to trap it, to keep it off of it. So it kind of has I love ladybugs for that. And they kind of have a dual effect where they kind of kill the bad insects, but they also stress the cannabis plant out enough to, you know, produce more trichomes.
Well, I did not know that. I'm going to go and stop and get me some ladybugs on the way home. Then that's brilliant. I did not know. Really, the trichome production part. Wow, that's beautiful. I feel ashamed that I didn't know that now, but yeah, that's beautiful. Is that your? Do you use any sort of sprays or organic oils for pest management in addition to the ladybugs, or is that the only thing you use?
Honestly, I've been very lucky throughout my growing, and I haven't had to use any.
Nice. Yeah, I use neem oil at home. I when in the commercial grow environment, you know, they had to use things that I really not even speak of anymore. But that was part of the reason I left, was just discussing the spray cannabis plants with pesticides that are meant for ornamentals.
Yeah. Definitely, you not even taste it. It's just good.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just going, I'm sorry, I was kind of lost on that ladybug knowledge, because it definitely makes sense to me as far as the bugs landing on it and the trichome production, because I have seen plants that looked amazing, and then you get up close and look at them like, oh, it has a bunch of aphids on it. So that kind of explains why that happened. I always wondered.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're right. And I
kind of started out with plant that had gotten budworms is that budworms come from cabbage moths, and I have a vegetable garden out back, and it reseeds itself every year, and I grow a lot of kale, and kale is part of the cabbage family, and it attracts those little white butterflies. Those are, you know, basically cabbage butterflies. And then I saw them floating around, you know, my cannabis plants, and was like, oh, how cool, you know, that's neat. And, you know, and I noticed that they were just, they started getting frosty at a very, very, very young age, you know, and just grew these really nice, dense amount of crystals. And then, you know, I cracked the bud open, and there's little green worms sort of wiggling around in there, and it was like, oh, darn.
Yeah, that's the worst. The worst is having a beautiful bud on the outside and then bringing it in to trim it and finding bud rot or something. I mean, everybody's been there. If you haven't been there, you're luckier than me. Because yeah, I've had a lucky experience as well, you know, not having too many pests at home. But if you haven't seen some bud rot or something, then congratulations.
I have, unfortunately. I think we all have. I think, you know, anybody who's grown enough cannabis is, you know, would probably be lying if they said they never had rot or mold or pests.
Right.
Like I say, I've been really, aside from those cabbage moths, which really don't do very much damage, it's just more the gross factor of there being worm poop on there that sort of bothers me. But, you know, for, you know, my own use, I cleaned it up really well, and I picked them all out, and I was like, well, you know, I'm like, it's not going to kill me.
Right. Nice. Yeah, being a grower will make you appreciate all forms of life, right?
It does. It really does. It's, you know, it's almost, you don't really, you want it to be very, very clean, but you don't want it to be sterile, you know, and that kind of leads me to the whole flavonoid to terpenoid to cannabinoid process, is that all of those things are the plant's own defense mechanism, which is kind of neat, is that your flavonoids are usually your antioxidants and your anti-inflammatories. And also a lot of them are neuroprotective. They're cell protective. So what it does, what it really is a sort of sequence of your flavonoids protecting the plant. And then from there, it protects the plant from certain things. And then terpenoids are more for the protection from like insects and things like that. And then when those flavonoids and terpenoids meet your olivitol and your geranylpyrophosphate, that's where all the magic happens. And from there, boom, that's where the trichome head comes in, and it goes into your cannabinoids. But really what it is this whole defense mechanism from start to finish. So the way I look at it, and just my own personal hypothesis is that, the when you talk about the neuroprotective capabilities and stuff of cannabis, is that when you extract, when you make oil, it's pretty important to include all that, which is why, and many of those are water soluble only, which is a big reason why I prefer to use ice wax, or else even the 5% amount of water that's in Everclear can do a pretty good job of grabbing some of those as well. So whereas if you have something completely non-polar, you're not going to get any, as you can see from lab tests, if you look at a concentrate, you'll see very, very, very high numbers of CBD or THC, say in a butane shatter, but usually the terpene content is up under 3%. And that's because it lacks the water to pull all those water soluble compounds from the plant. And that's why, shatter is slightly vary in color, but that's usually because of the harvest window in it. It's not really the color that's coming from the flavonoids. So it's not so much that, I'm against, if somebody just requires heavy cannabinoids and stuff, then using a solvent is probably the right way to go. But if you want to get down to all the way through, we're trying to protect ourselves. We're trying to protect our nerves. So we need to use what the plant uses to protect itself as well. So it's a whole kaleidoscope of healing when you add in all those things together, which is when people take whole plant, I think they don't really take it down to that level. They think whole plant as basically THC and CBD, or, extracting the whole bud and stuff like that. But you need to go a little bit farther down. And that's where the trichome stock comes in handy. Is that, if you don't want stocks in your shatter, of course, but as for me, that's where all the synthesis starts to really happen, is in the stock. That's where CBGA is concentrated. And from there, as it moves on up and starts to interact with your terpenes and stuff, that's when, the either oxidation, decarboxylation, methylation, all those different things happen to form your cannabinoids. So the stock, really, of the trichome is every bit as important, because it's got all those protective mechanisms that the cannabis plant has in it. So not using those, you lose a lot of that neuroprotection, and you lose a lot of, the anti-inflammatory properties of it. So.
Right. Yeah. Awesome knowledge. I think what we've already learned here in the first episode is not only is the certain strain important, but also how it's grown, how it's processed, how it's stored. And then in today's environment, with so many people doing dabs or using whatever extract, what is the solvent that they're using and how does that change it? Fresh, frozen, all these different aspects. And I love that you bring up the flavonoids and the terpenoids, and you're passionate about these other things, because we, for years and years, THC was known by everyone. And then 2013, right, CBD, now everybody knows CBD. But there's still several that are, out there and need to be explored and are beneficial, like CBG, like you mentioned. CBC is being shown to come up in some strains, and we don't really know what it is. I think a lot of people aren't even aware of the endocannabinoid system, like you brought up early. It's something that I hope me and you can continue to pound home, to let people understand that this plant has keys within itself that unlock CB receptors within our own body. And there's a dozen of them known already. And there's, a dozen cannabinoids known, and hundreds known, dozens are named. Some are in right, such minute quantities that we don't know anything about them yet. And as interest grows and strains, yeah, and breeders are encouraged to seek out these different cannabinoids, it's going to be very interesting in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I tend to look for, CBN is anticonvulsant, and it's also sedative. And I'm old school. I'm more of the, I mean, I like the sleepies of indica personally, especially at nighttime, and definitely I like to have that aspect of it. So I always look for CBN content, and then I look at CBC content. A lot of people don't realize CBC's almost main function isn't necessarily that it's medicine in itself, but CBC protects your endocannabinoids, which is kind of neat. So it gives protection to your endocannabinoids. So that's kind of a really cool thing about CBC, is not just that it's a phytocannabinoid, but it actually has a profound effect on your endocannabinoids as well. Because I guarantee if you were to, you know, I'm sure if you were to talk to, like, be able to talk to a Raphael Meshulam or someone like that, they could probably tell you that, you know, that anandamide is 1,000 times more potent than THC probably is. If you were to break it down to a molecule, your endocannabinoid system comes first before your phytocannabinoids, and it's learning how, you know, how that works.
Interesting. So it sounds like ingesting CBC would help all the other cannabinoids function even more efficiently. Is that what you think too?
Exactly. What's interesting is CBC is not psychoactive, but if you add a high CBC to a high THC, you'll get pretty stoned.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Everything is based upon my hypothesis from, you know, learning, reading, talking to others, and also my own experience. But really what I think it does is it doesn't increase the potency of cannabis-based THC, but it probably helps out your endocannabinoids, your anandamide, that's basically your body's own THC.
Right.
To be more absorbed into, you know, to bind better. And it's also, they're also found, CBC is found in high concentrations in the GI tract. So it would be really good for someone with Crohn's to incorporate CBC in there, and CBCA as well.
Is that an accepted condition down there in New Mexico, Crohn's?
Yes, we have, we have 16 covered. Nice. So we have a pretty comprehensive program that we've had for, I think we're going on our 10th year.
And you do have PTSD as well also, right?
We have PTSD. We have, of course, you know, just about anything nervous system related is included in there. In fact, our highest amount of enrollees in our New Mexico program is, I believe, PTSD. We have a big military community here, even though we're a small state. And we also we get a lot of people who like to retire in the southern part of the state.
So sure. Yeah, nice and warm down there.
In fact, one of my favorite employees at our dispensary used to guard the cannabis fields and hash makers fields in Afghanistan. He was on active duty there, you know, and that was his job. And he learned how to make, you know, the sort of original Afghani hash by, you know, actually being there in the fields with the people doing it. So
the charis, you know, hand hash.
Yeah, he said that he was so lucky because he noticed that his platoon was not experiencing the same symptoms as the other platoons when it comes to PTSD. You know, so it's, and he was like, and so it kind of hit him when he got home. He was like, duh.
Wow, yeah. So, and I bet using that hash, that charis hand hash, is, you know, you're taking those THC molecules and bashing them up, degrading them, and throwing them, probably turns into CBN pretty quick. And that, and through my research, is something that's real beneficial for people with the PTSD, is tells them to store their weed longer, to let the THC degrade, grow it out longer, let the THC degrade to CBN, because that's the thing that's going to have the calming effect for the veterans and others that suffer from PTSD.
And what seems to work is, I know of two specific strains, and that's Jack the Ripper and Willie Nelson. are bred specifically for THCV. And THCV strains are, and CBDV strains are getting, what's really cool about them is that they form both standard, your both standard cannabinoids and also your varying cannabinoids. So you get, when you talk about full spectrum, you really can't get, I found a one-to-one CBDV to THCV phenotype at one of the dispensaries here, and it was beautiful, and it smelled good, and it had a really high CBN amount as well. And they were using that, they were suggesting that for their PTSD patients.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm very interested in the THCV and all the variants, really. Might have the opportunity to do a little bit of work with a quote-unquote hemp strain that's high in THCV. So I'm looking forward to that. I haven't experienced any of it, but I've heard that it's it can have a real psychoactive effect. I'm not sure if that's true or not. And I also love that it's not part of the CSA, the Controlled Substance Act. It's like one of these things that's kind of in the gray area. So that excites me as far as moving in that direction.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, they can pull the, there's an analog act out, you know, that they could potentially pull on it. But as far as it goes now, it's technically not, the barons are not considered, you know, THC.
Right.
So, you know, as long as we can, you know, if we could keep that going, that would be a really good thing. So,
yeah. But, yeah. I'm not, not too optimistic about it. I'm sure if somebody started producing it in mass quantities, they're going to want their cut and all that such. But,
go ahead. What I found, because I suffer, you know, from PTSD from, you know, not only my condition, but the surgeries and stuff involved and, you know, the other aspects of being ill, is that what I found for most people who have, you know, a psychological disorder is that they don't get high at all from THCV. Whereas your average Joe, you know, who, you know, has a, you know, completely, you know, good functioning brain, gets really high off of them. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, so that goes back to the different effects on different people and just how it might not be just simple down to where you can quantify the effects of one strain, but certainly not when you bring into those growing conditions and such that I spoke of earlier.
Yeah, can we reset for about 1 minute?
Yeah, 1 second.
Okay.
I really appreciate all our live listeners out there. I hope you're enjoying and picking up a lot of knowledge from mostly Mike. He's really already taught me a handful of things, so it's awesome. We're going to get ready here to wrap it up in just a second. We'll let Mike sort out his end, and we'll have some closing words and kind of what we'll be shooting for in our next episode. I don't want to say any names or anything, but I am hoping to exploit all my connections and get some very interesting people in here to talk about genetics, people that have been breeding for a long, long time and created things that you probably put in your pipe. And I'd like to thank all the people on YouTube as well. The show will be airing on Tuesdays in a cut-down format, so you'll not hear all the awkward pauses and such. It's going to be at 7 p.m. on the Millennium Grow Network. All the links will be provided for you for sure. We're going to – it's that's 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. It's awesome to have the opportunity to reach out and speak to people in some other regions and such. I know that due to Dean's connections, we're speaking to some people that are listening down there in Texas, one of the more restrictive states when it comes to cannabis. So everybody down there that has a condition that knows cannabis can help them, my sympathies lie with you, and hope it can turn around in all these states so everybody can have access to the medicine they need. I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. And yes, and Amy's connections from Oklahoma, the same thing. You know, our medical refugees that are bringing a lot of attention to our state and and doing it in a great way. I really appreciate Amy and Dean for this opportunity. Hope that we can make it grow into something real big and spread the knowledge and have a real political effect to help help liberate the plant, basically. Amy had suggested here from off camera that maybe I give some tips to first-time growers. I would say to first-time growers, pay attention to your environment, humidity, heat. All these things are huge factors that will go into your success. Don't overwater would be a big tip for you. And definitely. Just keep at it. Know that we've all made mistakes and just learn from your mistakes. That's all there is to it. You're going to just know what you did wrong, basically. Pick up a book and if something went wrong, find out what it was and just make the next round better. Every round, every grower I know, they just improve. Isn't that right, Mike?
Absolutely. And it gives you even more excitement for your next grow. So I think, I had taken such a long break off of growing that my first grow was, one of those plants that looks like it's going to be really good until it's cured. And you're like, oh, I messed up somewhere.
Right. Yeah. You throw it out.
My room is too hot.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think we're about to wrap it up here. I really enjoyed it, Mike. I'm looking forward to our next show. Looking forward to seeing our listeners' reaction when this airs again on Tuesday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Any closing words that you have to say?
Not really. I definitely want to, let people know that, we will get to where we will talk about specific strains and the conditions they treat. But really what Nick and I were trying to do today was sort of, take it down to the plant level and what makes a strain a strain. Before that way you already have a little bit of background knowledge into, the next step, which is actually going to the dispensary or your caregiver and finding the strain that you want. So I think that, it's very important to educate about the plant so that, it really helps everybody to learn about the plant before they just want learn about, go buy this, and that's, you need to know why you're going to buy this.
Right. Yeah. Beautifully put. Exactly. And to know that there are different conditions and different strains that are being able to help you. So just because we spend an hour next week talking about ChemDog or OG Kush doesn't mean that's got to be the one that works for you. I really am looking forward to that and lining up some guests. I don't know if you heard that, but I'm looking forward to hopefully having some guests for our next episode. We can go deep into some breeding and like you said, what makes a strain? Like, to make one strain, it takes two strains, right?
Right.
All right.
You can get into back crossing and all that good stuff, and which has a effect as well. So there's a whole that's going to be. I'm really looking forward to that on a personal level for myself. Breeding is still very new to me, so that will definitely. I know my breeds and I know what I like, but, as far as doing it myself, I would love to learn more about that.
Yep. Same here. I have a few that are popping in a tent for the first time. I'm anxious to see what I got and learn more about it as I do it. I really appreciate all you guys listening today. Feel free to reach out to either Mike or myself and ask us any questions or suggest us any strains or topics that you want to hear us talk about in the future. Thank you for listening to Strain Talk with myself, Nick McCombs, and Mike Morris on the Millennium Grow Network. Have a great evening.
Yes, thank you very much for everything and for letting us ramble. Hope we made some sense to you. But it's as fun for us to talk about cannabis, as it is, to actually even use and grow cannabis.